Good evening. I would like to thank you all for coming to tonight's lecture in our three-year Templeton Research Lecture Series on the constructive engagement of science and religion. My name is Jim Proctor. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Geography at UC Santa Barbara. Our program, entitled Science, Religion, and the Human Experience, seeks to shed scholarly light on the ways that science and religion are embedded in, yet seek to transcend, the historical, political, psychological, and other contexts defining the human experience. Further information on our program and remaining lectures scheduled for this year may be found on the tables in the back or on our website, which is listed on the brochures. I would like to briefly acknowledge the John Templeton Foundation, whose support we appreciate for this series. I would also like to acknowledge UC Santa Barbara's College of Letters and Science, Office of Institutional Advancement, Office of Instructional Resources, and Institute for Social, Behavioral, and Economic Research for administrative support. Tonight's talk, by the way, is co-sponsored by UCSB's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology. Tonight and tomorrow night, we are pleased to feature two world-class scholars whose areas of research address one of the most well-known, yet probably more controversial topics in science and religion dialogue, at least in the United States, and that, of course, is Darwinian evolution. Tonight we will hear Michael Ruse, Lucille T. Workmeister Professor of Philosophy at Florida State University, deliver a lecture with the rather tongue-in-cheek title of Darwinism and Atheism, A Marriage Made in Heaven. Tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. in Isla Vista Theater, Bruce Tiffany, UCSB Professor of Geological Sciences, follows up with a talk on, and here's another slightly tongue-in-cheek title, The Origins of Science in Religion, or Parents and Offspring Should Respect Each Other. We are grateful that Professors Ruse and Tiffany have agreed to comment on each other's talks. In addition, Professor Stephen Rothstein of UCSB's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology will offer comments on Professor Ruse's talk, and tomorrow night, Professor Porter Abbott of English will do the same for Professor Tiffany's talk. There are index cards that should have been on your seat when you came in. If you would like to deliver a question following the lecture to Professor Ruse or the two discussants, feel free to write the question legibly on the index card. They will be collected later, and I will select as many as we have time to deliver. Well, now I would like to introduce our speaker for this evening, Professor Michael Ruse. The short version is that he is the Lucille T. Workmeister Professor of Philosophy at Florida State. As I've said, a graduate of Bristol University in England, he has taught for 35 years at the University of Guelph in Canada. The long version is much longer, much, much longer, and when you take a look at his CV online, one could go on forever and ever. I think he has publications, speaking engagements, debates that are endless, in fact, continued through this afternoon. A long list of honors, of which I would mention two: a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and South of the 49th, a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. A set of book publications, which is impressive in its size and its diversity, roughly 20 book publications through his long career, many focusing on his focus in the philosophy of biology. Let me read briefly the titles of some of his more recent books so you can understand exactly why we have invited him to come speak here tonight. Monad to Man, The Concept of Progress in Evolutionary Biology. Mystery of Mysteries, Is Science a Social Construction? Can a Darwinian be a Christian? The Relationship Between Science and Religion. Readings in the Philosophy of Biology. And finally, The Evolution Wars, A Guide to the Debates. Professor Ruse has been somewhat of a friendly gadfly in many of these discussions around evolution in the context of science and religion. I think it's a role he relishes and does with excellence, and I think it is because of his attitude. I would like to briefly read a response he made to one of his critics in a debate on reductionism. First, let me express my appreciation to my critics. People often think that criticism will hurt or offend, but this is not true. What really hurts and offends is when one's ideas raise no spark of interest and no one bothers to respond at all. Well, I guess I would say, Michael, that in the spirit of open engagement and certainly airing of the controversy of Darwin in the context of science and religion, we welcome you here tonight.
Well, thank you very much indeed. As you heard, I spent 38 years of my life in Canada, and so I'm used to starting my talks by saying, I'd like to welcome you all tonight and thank you for making your way here through the snow. So I would like to thank you all tonight and welcome you and thank you for making your way through the snow. I'm a philosopher and historian of science, and I'm particularly interested in the whole question of science and culture and the way that it works, and particularly interested in Darwinian evolutionary theory. And what I want to do tonight is to talk to you about Darwinism and about religion, and in particular about the Christian religion. And you'll learn that there are reasons why I'm talking about Christianity. In fact, I'm talking about Protestant Christianity. There are reasons why I'm doing this. It's not that I'm anti-Jew or anti-Hindu or anything like that, but I do think that Darwinism and Christianity have a symbiotic relationship, and I don't want to pinch the talk of the person tomorrow night, but certainly I would go as far as to say that it's certainly a family relationship between Christianity and Darwinism. And what I want to do tonight is, well, in a way, my talk comes in two acts with a foreword, and it's going to be slides all the way, so you won't just have to listen to me. And I want to give you just a little foreword or a prologue just to explain to you why it is that, or what it is, I think, that we've got facing us at the moment and the debate that's going on. And then I want to sort of dig into the main part of my talk. And the first act, as it were, will lead us into the whole relationship between Darwinism and Christianity. And I hope at the end of the first act, you'll be saying, well, then why on earth was there any conflict? Why on earth was there any tension? Which there obviously is. And the second act will be to try to show you why there has been tension between Christianity and science, particularly evolution. And I warn the evolutionists, of which I am one tonight, that I'm going to be making some suggestions which they may find surprising, and if we're lucky, they may find deeply offensive. Okay? So, without further ado, can we turn down the lights and can we get going? Okay. Well, this, of course, is Richard Dawkins, the English sociobiologist and biologist, who is well known as the author of The Selfish Gene, a wonderful book on sociobiology and evolutionary biology that was published in 1976, and who is well known today for his ardent atheism and his very strong beliefs that anybody who subscribes to any religion, particularly Christianity, has literally gone soft in the head, and he said as much in print. And so on the one hand, what we've got is one of the world's most prominent evolutionists, certainly the most public evolutionist, let's at least say that much, who is very strongly and ardently pushing not only evolution, but pushing atheism as well, and who in later books has made no bones that he thinks that if indeed you are an evolutionist, then you ought to be an atheist, and conversely. Now, what's happened to my slides? Oh, there we are. On the other hand, what we have, particularly in America, but by no means exclusively in America, but particularly in America, we've got an equally ardent group of people who are generally ardent Christians of one sort or another. There are one or two Jews and one or two others, but certainly ardent Christians, including this man, and this man is Michael Behe of Lehigh University, who is in fact a Roman Catholic. And these people feel very strongly that Darwinism is a mistaken view. Behe has published a book called Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. And Behe makes no bones about it, that as far as he is concerned, as a practicing Christian, he thinks that evolution is at best suspect and at worst thoroughly pernicious. In fact, Behe himself is probably not as extreme on evolution as some others, including somebody who was talking here this afternoon, Jonathan Wells, but certainly we've got a very ardent group of people, often evangelical Christians, but as Behe shows us, by no means exclusively so, who feel very strongly that if one's a Christian, then one ought not be an evolutionist, and if one is an evolutionist, then clearly one cannot be a true Christian. So as I say, this is my prologue. We've got people on both sides, evolutionists and Christians, and they're looking at each other across the trenches and yelling at each other and saying, boo sucks, you're wrong, no, we're wrong, we're right, and you're wrong, and so on and so forth. My problem tonight is, why do we have this particular clash, and what's going on? And obviously, at one level, one would like to do something about it, but I'm an academic, so unlike Karl Marx, I'm trying to understand the world rather than change it. Okay, so into the first act of my talk, and the first act, as I say, is about the whole relationship between evolution, between Darwin's evolution in particular, and religion, and by religion, I mean Christianity. Now, if we go back to the beginning, what we find is, of course, that Christianity was not something which sort of just appeared, nor was it something that sprang into existence as Jesus was being taken down from the cross or as he rose on the third day. In fact, Christianity was something which had to be articulated by the followers of Jesus and those who came after. First of all, most obviously, St. Paul, as he was doing in his various epistles, and then later by the great church fathers up to, and certainly including St. Augustine, around about 400. AD. And what we find is that right from the beginning, the great church fathers, particularly St. Augustine, said, of course we accept the Bible, of course we accept the story of Adam and Eve. But what one should recognize is that the Bible, particularly the early chapters of the Old Testament, were written for rather primitive people, nomads, not sophisticated Romans as we are, and that therefore God had to speak to them in the language that they could understand. What we should do is take the Bible as true, always. What we should do is take the Bible as literally true. But if it turns out that modern science, modern research shows that certain things are wrong, then you must drop the literal truth and interpret the Bible allegorically. St. Augustine, I should say, was particularly keen on this. As a young man, he'd been a Manichaean. He was born of a Christian mother, a pagan father, but he'd been a Manichaean. And part of the Manichaean belief was that the Old Testament is wrong. So St. Augustine knew all of the problems with the Old Testament, the two creation stories and the inconsistencies. So that when St. Augustine returned to Christianity, one of the things that he was telling his fellow Christians was, don't get hung up on two literal readings, because you're just laying the way open to the pagans and they're going to get you if you do this. So the point I want to make is that it has always, always been part of the Christian tradition that the Bible is true, but that if necessary, and sometimes it's very necessary, the Bible is to be interpreted in a metaphorical or allegorical way. Now, as one goes up through the 15th and 16th centuries, in fact, as new scientific discoveries were being made, people felt more and more confident that the Bible could indeed be meshed fairly well with the discoveries. Noah's flood, for instance, they found fossil fish up at the top of the Alps, and people said, well, obviously, obviously these are the remains of Noah's flood and so on and so forth, and so everything seemed to look pretty good. But by the time of the 18th century, more and more evidence was starting to come up to suggest that maybe the flood was a local event, and that maybe it wasn't a universal event, and maybe the flood hadn't worked quite as people thought, and that maybe, and people were now starting to look at some of the Old Testament stories in light of then modern anthropology and so on and so forth. And people were starting to, having to interpret, particularly the Old Testament, sometimes quite dramatically. At the same time, what we find is that people are starting to push back the age of the earth as fossil discoveries and these sorts of things are being turned up. And at the same time, finally, by the end of the 18th century, a number of people are starting to approach or to accept evolutionary ideas. So the evolutionary idea is the idea that everything comes from one or a few forms and up to and including ourselves. One of the first evolutionists was this man, this rather corpulent-looking man, and this is Dr. Erasmus Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandfather, who was a well-known physician in England at the end of the 18th century. Now, it's interesting to ask immediately, what was the motivation making Erasmus Darwin into an evolutionist? Sure, he got a certain amount of fossil evidence and that sort of thing, but if you read what he wrote, you find that that wasn't really what motivated him. In particular, Erasmus Darwin was a great enthusiast for the late 18th century views about progress. Erasmus Darwin believed that there is social progress and the possibility of more. That through education, through medicine, through industry, and don't forget we're now into the Industrial Revolution, it is possible for humans to raise themselves up and to better themselves from the primitive people that they were before. What Erasmus Darwin did was take these ideas of social progress, read them into the fossil record, and thus get evolution. Now, this is not, in fact, a picture of his. This is a picture from Ernst Haeckel in the second half of the 19th century, but it's very much the picture of evolution that Erasmus Darwin had. So, of course, this is in German. But you start with the primitive forms, the monads, and then you work up through the amphibians and so forth, and then you get up to the apes, and then you get up to the mention, and then if you're English, you get up to the English, and if you're German, you get up to the Germans, and so on and so forth. And so you've got this progressive view, which you then read back into the social view, and as it were, and then you've got justification for your social views at the same time. So this, as I say, was very much how evolution came into being, very much as a kind of epiphenomenon of a social, a philosophical view. Now, what was the religious position? I mean, did Erasmus Darwin have to go against Christianity in order to be an evolutionist? Well, as it happens, to a certain extent, I don't want to deny that he did. He was not a Christian. Erasmus Darwin was not a Christian, and in fact the idea of progress, social progress, was certainly at that time taken to be antithetical to Christianity, not because it went against the literal word of the Bible, because people were no longer into that, but because Christianity sees everything that happens as due to God's providence. You know, without God's help, we are as nothing. You remember the famous hymn, you know, my everything I count as naught, and pour contempt on all my pride. Providence is the idea that we do nothing on our own, we do it only through God's grace. Progress is the idea that we can do things ourselves. So there was certainly tension there. But I do want to emphasize that Erasmus Darwin was not an atheist. He did not, as it were, give up Christianity on Friday morning and say, well, to hell with God, that's a pile of BS, isn't it? What shall I do on Friday afternoon? Let's think up evolution. In fact, Erasmus Darwin was a very sincere believer, but he believed in a God who was an unmoved mover. In other words, he believed in a God who did not get involved in the world miraculously after the creation had been performed, because thanks to what God had done in his magnificence at the beginning, everything would unfurl. So, of course, for Erasmus Darwin, unbroken law and evolution was very much a proof of his position rather than a refutation. He's known technically, the position that Erasmus Darwin had is known technically as deism, as opposed to the Christian theist who believes in a God who is an intervener. I should say that Erasmus Darwin was by no means unique in being a deist in those days, and a great many other intellectuals at the time were, including Erasmus Darwin's great friend Ben Franklin, And incidentally, Erasmus Darwin wasn't friends with all seven of them, but the first seven presidents of the United States of America, and this may come as a surprise, particularly given the last election when both candidates were going around saying, Jesus is my favorite philosopher, I never do anything without asking his help. But in fact, the first seven presidents of the United States of America were not Christians. They were not atheists. They were not agnostics. They were deists. They're often very much bound up with being Unitarians. Unitarians, they believe in the unity. They deny the Trinity. They believe Jesus is a good man, but not the Son of God. And so this is the kind of position that somebody like Erasmus Darwin is expressing. So what I'm saying is that evolution right back then comes out of a religious background. It's not a Christian background, but it comes out of a religious background. And it's very interesting to note that the great critics of evolution, and this was one of the greatest critics, this is Georges Cuvier, the French comparative anatomist at the beginning of the 19th century. Cuvier was a violent opponent of evolution. Now, why was he an opponent of evolution? Well, it's very interesting to note, Cuvier was a Protestant, but Cuvier would never, ever have opposed evolution on biblical grounds. It would never have occurred to Cuvier to take the Bible out and say, there you are, Adam and Eve, it couldn't be so. What he objected to about evolution was the whole notion of progress, because Cuvier, as a Christian, felt that God was a providential God. Plus, of course, Cuvier was living in France at the beginning of the 19th century, and he'd seen, with some justification, that the philosophy of progress had led to the French Revolution, and Cuvier very much wanted to avoid a repeat of this. So these were the sorts of reasons that were going on at the beginning of the 19th century as evolution was being debated. All right, well, now let's bring in the hero of our story, and he certainly is the hero of my story, and this is Charles Robert Darwin, the Englishman, born in 1809, born actually on the same day as Abraham Lincoln, and died in 1882. And what I want to do right from the beginning is I'd like to stop for a moment and just talk for a moment about this picture. This is a drawing done by a man called George Richmond, which was done around about 1839, 1840. In fact, 1839 is the probable date. It's a wedding portrait. Photography was only just coming in then, and so generally people had their portraits drawn when they got married. And the thing I want to draw your attention to here is that this is a very good quality drawing. This is not a sketch by an amateur. It's a really good quality picture, and there's good reason for this. George Richmond was the best portraitist in England of the day. And that tells you something right there, that Charles Darwin came from a segment of society that could afford to have the best portraitist of the day paint his portrait. And this, I think, is absolutely crucial to understanding Darwin. Darwin is not somebody who's living in a garret on a crust of cheese with a candle burning down, hating society and saying, I'm going to get them. I'm going to become an evolutionist and make them all uncomfortable. This was not Darwin at all. Darwin was not an aristocrat. He was not a lord or something like that. But he was from very much the upper middle class of English society, which was doing very well out of English society, particularly out of the Industrial Revolution. So what you should expect to find, and I think you do find with Darwin, is that he is not the Christian God. He is not going to make everything new. He is going to take the good things that he got as an upper middle class Englishman, take them in, shake them up as in a kaleidoscope, and then represent them. And I think that religion, as you're going to see, including the Christian religion, is a very important part of this. So this is, as I say, is what we're going to see in Darwin, is picking up these pieces and, as it were, recasting them in some way, rather than going anew. All right, well, what about Darwin? His father, the son of Erasmus Darwin, is this rather even more corpulent-looking gent, Robert Darwin. It turns out that Robert Darwin was both a physician and a very successful money man. As a doctor, he could mix with all segments of society. And industrialists had money to lend. Aristocrats wanted to raise money through mortgages on their land. Dr. Darwin, of course, would see both sides professionally. And he was a very good middleman. And as middlemen do, quite a bit of money stuck on him that way. So the Darwins had got a lot of money there. And then on Darwin's mother's side, there was even more money, because on Darwin's mother's side, this is the Wedgwood family, Josiah Wedgwood, the potter, you know, the blue and white pottery. That's old Josiah Wedgwood over in the corner. That's Darwin's mother, the young woman on the horse. And the young man to the far right is Josiah Wedgwood, well, we call him Josiah Wedgwood Jr., and he, in fact, is destined to become the father-in-law of Charles Darwin as well, because Charles Darwin married Emma Wedgwood, his first cousin. And once again, you see evidence. This is a picture by George Stubbs, the great horse painter. Once again, what you've got is a testament to wealth, to success, and everything like that. The horses are of the best. The grounds that they're in, the fashions that the wife and the daughter are wearing are all testaments to people who have done, not only done well, but done well out of the Industrial Revolution. Now, it's interesting to note that the Wedgwoods were, in fact, Unitarians, so they were deists already. The Darwin family were Anglicans, members of the Church of England, or what you would call Episcopalians. It seems pretty clear that Dr. Robert Darwin was probably, if anything, an atheist, but of course, given his social position as a physician and everything like that, he kept that very, very quiet indeed. Well, what was to happen? Young Charles Darwin is born, he grows up, the idea is he's going to become a physician like his father and grandfather before him. He's packed off at 17 to Edinburgh University, the best medical school in Britain, if not one of the best in the world, and after 2 years he's had enough. 2 years of getting up on a cold Edinburgh morning, and if you've ever been in Edinburgh in the winter, you'll know what it's like. The other problem with Edinburgh, it's filled with Scotsmen. He'd have to get up there and listen to dry old Scotsmen lecture on dry old subjects about herbs and that sort of thing. Oh, hi, laddie. After 2 years, he'd had a bellyful of that. So he goes home, and there's a family discussion, and here he is. He's young, he's handsome, he knows he's got lots of money, so he's not going to have to work for a living. You know, dear God, what are we going to do with this, you know, kid, this idol? Well, what do you do today? You know, you send them to FSU or to UC Santa Barbara and say, go and do sociology for 4 years or something like that, and don't bother us, come back when you've finished that. Well, they didn't have sociology degrees or religion degrees or even philosophy degrees in those days, but they did have the equivalent. There was one career that a young man who was fairly well off, who was personable, not too driven, perhaps not too bright, could go in and a job for a gentleman. And this was to make a clergyman out of them. And by clergyman, I mean a clergyman of the Church of England. So one has to say somewhat cynically, given his own beliefs, Dr. Robert Darwin agreed in 1826, 1827, that young Charles Darwin could become a clergyman. So young Charles Darwin, who incidentally at this time, you know, he was asked, he said, oh yes, I believe in the Bible, I'm a Christian, and I think he genuinely was packed off to the University of Cambridge, Christ College, Cambridge, where he spent three very happy years not killing himself with hard work. But it turns out, that he didn't do a biology degree, he didn't do, you know, a course, you know, in evolution and ecology, because there were no degrees in evolution and ecology in those days. He did a little bit of Latin, a little bit of Greek, a little bit of Greek, a little bit of Latin, a little bit of mathematics. But it turns out that, in fact, Darwin was something of a square peg in a round hole. The courses in those days were very classics-oriented, and it's pretty clear that Darwin did have genuine scientific abilities. This is not somebody who's going to, as it were, bumble into what he does later on because just by luck. He was a pretty good scientist in developing this. There were people at Cambridge at the time who were interested in this. They spotted Darwin, and he became something of a protege. So in 1831... through a friend at the Admiralty, there came a chance for Darwin to be become the companion of a captain on board a British warship. And this is Captain Robert Fitzroy, who is in fact going to be the captain of HMS Beagle. There we are, HMS Beagle. Which is going to spend some 5 years in going around South America, mapping the coast around South America. Now, two things. First of all, why was Why was Fitzroy looking for somebody to come along with him? Well, Fitzroy, who incidentally was only 23 at the time, and incidentally was an aristocrat, his uncle was Viscount Castlereagh, the foreign minister. Fitzroy would be a man socially apart from the rest of the crew, the 180 crew, he would be socially apart, and also, as it were, professionally apart, because he was the captain. He was very much a person with life and death control over everybody else, which is fine, except that that meant he would be a very lonely person, because everybody else would be kowtowing to him, and he'd be a man on his own. So he was looking for a gentleman who would be outside, as it were, the command, who would go along and be the captain's friend, a gentleman who could afford to pay his way, his mess bills, and these things. And through a friend of a friend, Darwin got the offer, and Darwin went along in that capacity. Pretty soon, Darwin became more than just a traveller. He became a very ardent naturalist and all of those sorts of things, and spent 5 years doing this. Now, why was the Beagle going down to South America? The Industrial Revolution is now picking up again after the Napoleonic Wars. England is churning out cheap goods, cheap cloth from Lancashire, cheap wool from Yorkshire, cheap metal products from the Midlands, from Birmingham and other towns like that, which are building and growing up. And of course, they're looking for markets. One of the best markets is South America, long established by the Portuguese and Spanish, rich because of the animals down there and because of the mineral discoveries that have been made. So money to spend. So the merchant ships are going down from Liverpool and elsewhere, laden down with goods down to South America. The last thing they need to do is go adrift on an unmapped shore or something like that. So the British Navy, not being at war now, sends a ship down to map around South America. And so that's why Darwin spends, in fact, from 1831 to 1836 doing just this. They set off from England, they go around South America, they go to that group of islands up at the top on the equator in the Pacific, the Galapagos Archipelago. They then cut across to Australia, New Zealand. They then go to South America, actually. They then go back for a short visit to South Africa and back home at the end. Now, Darwin doesn't become an evolutionist on the trip, but things happen to Darwin which are turning him into the way that he will become an evolutionist pretty much as soon as he goes home. Now, first thing is, when Darwin sets off, we know still he's a pretty ardent Christian. In fact, he joked. He said people used to joke because he used to take the Bible absolutely literally. Now, it's clear that on the Beagle voyage, Darwin's views changed from Christian theism very much to the kind of position which was held by his mother's family, if not to Unitarianism, at least to some kind of deism. So a God who is unmoved mover. Darwin ceased to believe in Jesus as the Son of God. He thought he was a good man, but he ceased to believe in miracles and all of those sorts of things. So this is a very important move that Darwin is going to make. And of course, obviously, this is going to prepare him, as it did his grandfather, for a move to evolution. Because once you're a deist and looking for the mark of God, not in miracles, but in unbroken law, then evolution, as it were, is a confirmation of this rather than any kind of refutation. So this is something which is going to happen. In fact, the big thing which happened to Darwin to make him this was this man here. This is Charles Lyell, the geologist. And Lyell had just started at the beginning of the 1830s to publish what turned out, in fact, to be three volumes, his great work, Principles of Geology, being an attempt to explain the former changes of the Earth's surface by reference to causes now in operation. And the first volume was given to Darwin as he left, and the others were sent when he was out there. Now, what is Lyell doing? By causes now in operation. Lyell says, give me lots and lots and lots of time. Give me the opportunity to... Can you move it along for me? Oh, there we are. Thank you. Give me lots of time, give me the opportunity to let the processes which are working today through unbroken law to work, and I can raise mountains, I can cause ruins, I can carve canyons. I do not need miracles to do these things. It's just natural processes going on and on and on. And Darwin buys into this very much. And in fact, Darwin, on the Beagle voyage, turns first to geology. He's not a biologist first, and Darwin becomes a very ardent Lyellian. One of the things that Lyle is doing is saying, how do we know these things are happening? How can we work out what's happened in the past? Well, often one of the biggest clues is the distribution of organisms today, because if we see the various distributions that organisms have today, then possibly we can work out what happened in the past. For instance, if you've got very similar organisms on two sides of a big canyon, then you might think that the canyon is relatively recent in geological time. Whereas if the organisms on two sides of a mountain are very, very different, then maybe the mountain is reasonably old or something along those sorts of lines. Lyle himself is not an evolutionist, but he's starting to move that sort of way. Now, what happens is that in 1836, Darwin goes to the Galapagos Archipelago. And Darwin and the captain, as the two gentlemen on board, are invited by the governor of the islands to go for dinner. And Darwin is sitting at dinner with the governor and having a good meal. And it's, you know, Darwin's saying, well, what a relief to have fresh meat after 6 weeks of salt beef at sea and all of this sort of thing. And then Darwin says to the governor, tell me, governor, this is excellent chicken. I didn't see any chickens outside. And the governor starts to laugh and says, well, in fact, you're not eating chicken. You're eating tortoise. Tortoise. And then the governor says, the fascinating thing is, I can tell which island these tortoises come from. They're different tortoises on different islands. Now, Darwin is already keen to think about geographical distribution because he's a Lyellian. And Darwin says, my goodness me. Darwin had been collecting birds from island to island. We've still got the birds. We've still got the skins. And Darwin hadn't realized. He realized they were different species, but he hadn't realized they were different species on different islands. And he looks at these, and he's absolutely staggered. How could it be that these islands, only 10 miles apart, nevertheless have different birds on different islands? You see, what makes it so dramatic is Darwin's just been in South America, and sometimes he's seen the same species of bird up in the steamy jungles of Brazil and the snowy deserts of Patagonia down at the bottom. So God doesn't love birds that much that he fixes them just like, you know, like polar bears, so they're just for one spot. And yet, apparently, God so loved the Galapagos that he's put different birds on different islands. And basically, and I take this quite seriously, Darwin is saying something along the lines of, God couldn't have been so stupid to have done that. Now, he doesn't become an evolutionist at this point because he's still not convinced that his birds are, in fact, different species. If they're not different species, then maybe it's nothing significant. He goes home at the end of 1836, and Darwin takes his birds, bird skins, to a man called John Gould. And it already shows how Darwin is moving up in the social, scientific social structure, because Gould was the leading ornithologist of the day. And Gould looks at these skins and says, there's no question, these are different species. These are different species. So Darwin, and it's very interesting, because, you know, creationists are always saying, you know, why do you believe in evolution, or why not? Because of the fossils, because of the fossils. It's not the fossils which are the key thing to turning Darwin into an evolutionist. It's geographical distribution. And Darwin says there's no way that those birds could have gotten on those different islands except through a natural process of transformation. He's already read his grandfather's works. He's looking for a law-bound view. He's the grandson of an industrialist, so he's keen on progress, all of these things, and so he slips over very naturally into being an evolutionist. Not for Christian reasons, but certainly for religious reasons. Darwin's evolutionism comes because of religion rather than despite it. But, and now here comes what is even more interesting, is because now we've seen the Wedgwood side, as it were, kick in, and now we're going to see the Darwin side kick in. Because Darwin is a graduate of the University of Cambridge. The greatest scientist that the University of Cambridge had ever had was Sir Isaac Newton, and Darwin, of course, knew all about Sir Isaac Newton. What was Newton's great contribution to science? Well, it wasn't that he put the sun at the center, because Copernicus did that. It wasn't that he made the planets go in ellipses. Kepler did that. It wasn't that he made cannonballs go in parabolas. Galileo did that. What Newton did was bring it all together on one theory with one causal force, gravitation, a causal force of gravitation. And from this, Newton could explain everything. Darwin was a very ambitious young man. He wanted, he would have wanted a Nobel Prize if they'd been going in those days. Darwin wanted to be the Newton of biology. So Darwin realized being an evolutionist was not enough. He'd got to become a causal evolutionist and come through with causes. And so for the next 18 months, Darwin works privately on the issue of causes. And these are some of the private notebooks that Darwin kept during that time as he scribbled very hard. Now, there were two moves to becoming a Darwinian evolutionist, that's to say, getting the cause. First of all, Darwin had got to get some kind of mechanism, and then he'd got to show how the mechanism works in the world. Now, Darwin came from rural England. He came from Shropshire, and the Darwin family had kept pigeons, and his uncle Josh, his future father-in-law, was into sheep breeding and that sort of thing. So Darwin realized very early on that if you're going to change shapes, the way you do it is by selecting and by breeding. In other words, if you want to breed the bigger and better, you choose the bigger and better and eat or reject the small ones, and you breed from the bigger and better. If, on the other hand, you want the shaggier, then, you breed from one of my commentators over there, you breed from the shaggy one, and you kill that, the ones who are bald and shaven and all of that. In other words, you pick, you select. And Darwin saw that selection was very important. But more than this, Darwin saw that selection was going to solve what he, Darwin, saw as the big problem in the organic world. What's the big problem in the organic world? What is it that characterizes the organic world? And this is adaptation, the fact that the organic world seems as if it were designed, the hand and the eye. Why did Darwin take this issue so clearly, so seriously? Because he was a graduate of the University of Cambridge, and he'd been brought up on the books of this man, the Reverend Archdeacon Paley, Archdeacon of Carlisle, who wrote the famous work Natural Theology, which was published in 1802, and which Darwin had to read as an undergraduate. And in Natural Theology, what Paley had said is, how do we know that the existence of God? And just look at the top picture, this is from a later edition of Paley's, the top picture that counts. What Paley had said is, if you look at the eye is like a telescope. Telescopes have telescope makers, therefore the eye has an eye maker, the great optician in the sky. So, in other words, when you look at organisms, you don't just see blobs or random things. They're put together. They are as if designed. They are adapted because they are designed. Now, I think that Darwin always accepted this, certainly accepted this right through the writing of The Origin of Species. I think that Darwin bought into Paley's argument completely, that the world is, the organic world, is as if designed. And I think also he thought it was as if designed because it was designed by the great optician in the sky. However, Darwin wants a God who's going to be working through unbroken law rather than by hand, you see. So Darwin's God is going to create design, but through evolution. So this is the first component of his Anglican training lying on top of his Unitarian or deist background. But there's more than this, you see, because now Darwin can't—he can see it working in the animal world. He can see it working in the plant world, the breeder's world. But why should he think that it works in nature? And in 1838, at the end of 1838, in fact, September the 28th, 1838, Darwin read, as he said, for amusement, a work by another Anglican clergyman, and this is the Reverend Thomas Robert Malthus. And Malthus had written at the beginning of the 19th century his famous work, An Essay on the Principle of Population. You see, Malthus was asking himself this question: how is it that God has designed it so that when humans are born, they don't just sit on their backsides and do nothing? How is it that God has made the world so that when we're born, we don't just sit around and do absolutely nothing until we die? Well, because God has made it such that if you do that, life's going to be very unpleasant. And in particular, if you don't do anything and others do, you're going to lose out. Life is going to be a struggle for existence. And how has this come about? Because one thing that we all want to do is reproduce, and reproduction goes up faster than we can supply food supplies and that sort of thing. Now, it's interesting that Malthus is putting this forward in the context of a very conservative social doctrine, because what Malthus is saying is state welfare is useless. You have state welfare, and what happens? They don't do any work, they spend all their time bombing them away, and in the next generation you've got more of them. And if you feed them, then, you know, before long there's more of them, and it's all going to come collapsing down. So don't do it in the first place. Now, you see, Darwin's, and particularly the Wedgwoods, like this, because he basically said, you know, people should work, don't give them welfare, make them work, and we can keep the wages low because they've got to work, because there's, you know, no safety net underneath. So it's a very conservative doctrine. Darwin takes this and says, yes, there's going to be a struggle for existence, not just amongst humans, but in the world at large. And this struggle for existence means that only some are going to get through and some won't. And those that get through will, on average, have characteristics that help them to get through, and that, of course, is a natural form of selection. This is a picture from Malthus of what would happen if there were no struggle for existence. The numbers would just explode up like that. So now, by the end of 1838, Darwin is not only an evolutionist, but he's got his mechanism, natural selection. Natural selection, which can bring about and can cause adaptation, can explain why it is that organisms have adaptation. This is a picture of one of Darwin's finches. They weren't called Darwin's finches in those days, from the Galapagos. And this wonderful little bird with this huge great beak, which it uses, it's an adaptation for eating nuts and cactus and that sort of thing. What makes it so dramatic is other Darwin's finches are very thin because they're insectivorous, and others have medium types of... I'm sorry, folks. I'm enjoying myself too much, and I'm giving the poor chap at the back absolutely conniptions. Okay. Anyhow. So what is happening, then, is that Darwin is able to explain adaptation through his cause. But notice how the whole theory that Darwin has got, we don't know quite why. This is a picture of Darwin in his 1840s, and then finally Darwin publishes The Origin of Species in 1859, and we're not quite sure why it is that Darwin sat on his ideas for some... Now I seem to have lost my pictures completely now. I guess you came down to tell me off, and now... Are you going back up? Oh, yes. Quick. Okay. Anyhow, so in 1859, Darwin publishes The Origin of Species, which pushes not only the fact of belief of evolution, but the mechanism of evolution as well. Oh, dear. Well, I'm enjoying myself anyway. Which not only pushes the fact of evolution, but also pushes the mechanism of evolution. And the point I want to make is not that Darwin got his theory out of the Bible, because he certainly didn't. But the point I want to make is that Darwin's theory was itself, what shall I say, thoroughly religiously intoxicated, drenched. Darwin becomes an evolutionist because of his deistic beliefs, but then Darwin becomes a Darwinian because of his Christian, or if not his Christian beliefs now, but certainly because of his Christian background and his Christian training. And at no point could one say that Darwin's mechanism and Darwin's theory is something which is motivated by atheism. One couldn't even say that it's motivated by agnosticism. And we're also, as I say, also in a context where by this time people have long agreed that you don't have to take the Bible absolutely literally. Well, this, as I say, brings me to the end of the first act of my talk, and the situation I'd like to sort of present you with is this. Surely, if this were all there was to the story, why would there be a major confrontation between science and religion? Sure, there were differences, the whole question of progress and providence, for instance. So there were things to be worked out. But surely Christians have had to deal with these sorts of issues before. Think of Copernicus. Surely one would think that it would be possible for Christians to see the great overlap between Darwin's ideas and their own, and at least in some sense work with these, if necessary, modify them somehow, but at some level take them unto themselves. And yet what we seem to have had was an explosion and and everything went wrong, and science and religion found themselves opposed to each other. And so my second act is, why did this happen? But I should add that, in fact, there were some Christians who had very little trouble at all with Darwin's ideas. I mean, for instance, the Reverend Baden-Powell, the father of Robert Baden-Powell, the founder of Scouting, was one. Reverend Charles Kingsley, the author of The Water Babies. And just recently I've been reading works by John Henry Newman, probably the greatest theologian in England in the 19th century. Well, no, probably, certainly the greatest theologian. John Henry Newman, the leader of the Oxford movement in 1845, went over to Catholicism and ended up as a cardinal. And you look at Newman's writings in the 1860s, 1870s, and he's asked about Darwinism. He says, well, he says, frankly, I'm not that interested in these issues. I'm not a scientist, these are not my issues. But he says, I see absolutely no issues that would worry me whatsoever. He says, of course, I think immortal souls have to be something special, but that's not a scientific claim anyway. So as I say, at one level, there wasn't a controversy, but at another level, there clearly was. And the question I now ask as I start the second part of my talk is, why was there this controversy? And I think the reason to be found is in the work of this man here, and this is, you have to stay up there, I'm afraid. This is in the work of Darwin's great follower, the great bulldog for Darwin, Thomas Henry Huxley. Now, this, is, you might say, is surely this is a paradox. Huxley, Thomas Henry Huxley, that's the grandfather of Julian Huxley, the biologist, and Aldous Huxley, the novelist. Huxley was Darwin's great, great supporter. As I say, he was known as Darwin's bulldog. He was an ardent evolutionist. He preached evolution everywhere that he possibly could. And yet, I think, for reasons that I'm going to explain to you, it was Huxley who set the science-religion debate going, as it were, or if he didn't set it going, certainly poured oil on the fire. It was Huxley, particularly his work, for reasons I'll explain, who, as it were, brought us down to Richard Dawkins and Michael Behe today. Now, why would this be? Well, you must understand what Huxley was trying to do. Darwin was a rich man. He was ill. We don't know why. Darwin was not, he was a great scientist, but he was not a system builder. He was not a university man. I mean, he'd been to university, but he didn't work at a university or anything like that. Darwin didn't run a lab or any of these things. Darwin lived at home and wrote books. Huxley, on the other hand, was a great university man. Huxley was very much involved in building universities at that time. And Huxley, together with a group of other people, people like Tyndall and also some women, Florence Nightingale, realized that by 1860, England was in a mess. It was still feudal, looking to the back, and yet the Industrial Revolution had come along, and now, as it were, England was looking back socially to the 18th century, but needed to look forward, as it were, industrially and other ways to the 20th century. They'd had the Crimean War, where all of those people had died, not from injury, but from disease. Florence Nightingale. Then they'd had the Indian Mutiny in 1857. They had huge towns, places like Bradford. Bradford had been a village at the beginning of the 19th century. By 1860, Bradford had 100,000 people. Well, cities like Bradford needed things like sanitation. I mean, when you've got a village, you get up in the morning, what's the first thing you do? You open your front door and you take your chamber pot and you empty it out onto the street. Well, you can do that just in a village. But if you've got 100,000 people in a city, you know, doing this day by day by day, you know, pretty soon, you know, everybody's walking along like this. It's not much fun. You've got to have sanitation engineers. You've got to have local government. You've got to have people who are going to be building sewers. You've got to have organization. Laissez-faire won't do it. And Huxley was very much involved in this. He was very much involved in university education. And he saw that university education needed to be revised. Now, he was a biologist, so that was where he was involved. And one thing he saw is if you're going to upgrade university education, say if you're going to upgrade biology, and my two commentators would agree with this, the first thing you've got to think about if you're going to found a department or something like that is what need is there of this department? In particular, what will my students do? What can they do after I finish with them? You teach, you take them out, you have a wonderful afternoons looking at your cowbirds or something like that. It's great fun. But at the same time, you've got in the back of your mind, at the end of the 4 years, what are these kids going to do? I mean, are they going to go on to, say, further training and become university professors? Or is there work in environmental studies? Or is there government work? And all of these sorts of things. And you know perfectly well that your job and your institution depends on. And if, for instance, you turned around and said to, you know, your president, oh, well, I would like to start a department of the ecology of elephants, and I'd like to have grants so I can get 10 faculty, and we're going to get 20 graduate students, and in 5 years' time, we'll be turning out 25 elephant ecologists a year, the first thing your president is going to say to you is, well, that's all very well, but what are you going to do with 25 elephant ecologists? If you turn around and say, well, that's not my job, the president's going to say, but I'm afraid it's my job and you can't have the money. Now, Huxley realised, I'm sorry, oh God, I get so enthused, I'm having such a wonderful time. Oh, you see, there you are. You're such an inventive young man. You could have done this at the beginning, couldn't you? Oh, I'm sorry. There we go. Oh, the other, I'm the wrong way round. There are those who think my talk is the wrong way around too, but there we are. Okay. Oh, now I can move back and forth. All right, now there we are. Okay. All right. So Huxley was working very hard to upgrade biological education, and that meant that he had to find jobs for the boys. Now, one area that he found jobs for the boys was physiology. At this point, doctors were killing patients. It wasn't, in fact, until 1890 that going to a doctor was more likely to cure you than kill you. But certainly, they were killing people, and they realized this, and they were worrying about it. And so one of the things... I'm booming away. I mean, I don't know whether you can hear me, but I can. Okay. One of the things that Huxley did was he went to the medical profession. He said, look, you need people who've had 3 years of physiological training. I can give it to you. I can give it this to the people, and then you'll get them after I finish. The medical profession said, terrific, we'll take all that you can give us. And so that was one area that built up. Of course, everybody was a selfish gene. The medical profession said, and once we've got our trained physiologists, that means we can keep the chiropractors and osteopaths out, and they won't be able to charge the fees that we can. So, you know, everybody was benefiting. Another area was morphology. Cutting up dogfish and that sort of thing. Now, this was Huxley's own field. He said, what I want to do here is I want to introduce it into schools so that kids learn hands-on work with their hands rather than doing Latin and Greek. That's much better mind training for the new, as it were, the new Victorian than Latin and Greek. And so what Huxley did was turn out school teachers who'd been trained in morphology. His most famous student, of course, was H.G. Wells, the novelist, who took courses with Huxley. What about evolution? Huxley couldn't see any immediate payoff for evolution. Looking at fossils doesn't cure a pain in your belly. And, of course, you know, evolution was a bit of an iffy sort of theory. So what about evolution? Huxley couldn't see a way in which he could make evolution into a pucker professional discipline. But he could see a place for evolution because he saw the forces that he was fighting against, the aristocrats, the lords, the people in Parliament, were supported by one body particularly, namely the Anglican Church. The Episcopalian Church was very much part and parcel of the reactionary groups that Huxley and his fellows were fighting against. And so Huxley wanted to fight against the Anglican Church, and he certainly did this. One of the people that he was fighting against was this man. This is Samuel Wilberforce, Bishop of Oxford. Huxley had a great debate with the Bishop of Oxford, and the Bishop of Oxford turned to Huxley supposedly and said, tell me, Professor Huxley, are you descended from monkeys on your grandfather's side or your grandmother's side? And Huxley said, well, I'd rather be descended from a monkey than from a Bishop of the Church of England. In other words, everybody had a wonderful time. But the point is, Huxley saw the Anglican Church, Christianity, as representing the forces of reaction against which he and his fellows were fighting. He realized that in order to fight fire, you need fire. Fight fire with fire. He needed a secular religion which he could use to fight against Christianity. And in evolution, he saw he'd got it tailor-made. If you saw my last thing, evolution, particularly an evolution which was progressive, an evolution which, first of all, like Christianity, has a story of origins, and it has humans as the special focal point because they saw it as being progressive, and, as it were, it gives you directions on what you should do. And so Huxley saw and promoted evolution very much as an alternative, as a rival to Christianity, I think, for good social reasons. They even built cathedrals, except they didn't call them cathedrals. They called them museums of natural history. And this is where people would go on a Sunday to get all sorts of good instruction about hygiene and those sorts of things, and also the picture of evolution and these wonderful displays that people like the American Museum of Natural History had with the horses and all of these things, all leading up to humans and particularly up to the white man. As we all know, evolution goes. Now, it turns out that Darwin himself wasn't very good at this sort of thing, but there was another evolutionist who was very willing to go along with Huxley and help him in his work in doing this. And this, of course, was Huxley's, in fact, great friend. I lost my picture. There we are. This man here, and this was Herbert Spencer, and turned out to be a much more popular evolutionist than Darwin. And Spencer was very much given to world pictures like this. And notice that Spencer writes books on ethics, the data of ethics. What's an evolutionist doing the data of ethics? And of course, what Spencer is doing is preaching some kind of laissez-faire views where, you know, nature red in tooth and claw, and this is how society works, and how this leads to progress, and so on and so forth. So we've got this overall picture of the world, which is backed by evolution, which plays to people's prejudices. For instance, one of the big prejudices that Victorian Britain had was about the Irish. Everybody knew that the Irish were degenerate. In fact, there was something of a pecking order for evolution. You know, you've got the English up here, and then the Scots, and then the Americans, terrible table manners, the Americans, but and the French, and then you work down and darker and darker and darker and darker, and then debate, do you put the Terra del Fuegans, the savages from the bottom of South America, right at the bottom, and the Irish just above, or do you do it the other way around? The prejudice that people have got, look at this cartoon. The cartoons in Britain from 1859 on always portray Paddy, and you know it's an Irishman because he's got a tureen on his head, always portray Paddy as looking monkey-like. So as I say, evolution was taken over and fit in with the prejudices, just as people say, you know, Christianity fits in with other prejudices. And so, as I say, it became very much a secular religion, thanks to, I think, for good reasons, but that's the way that it went. Well, what was going to happen? What happened? Well, basically nothing happened for the best part of 50 years. And then finally, around about 1930, things did start to change. And a number of mathematicians, Sir Ronald Fisher in England, and J.B.S. Haldane, also in England, and then in America, your own Sewell Wright, the great population geneticist in America, these people started to put evolution on a mathematical basis. Mendelian genetics had arrived by now, and these people were starting to upgrade evolution. These were people who were keen very much to become not just evolutionists, but more than just sort of pop scientists, more than just people pushing a secular religion, but people with the same kind of professional status as physiologists and embryologists and morphologists and that sort of thing. Particularly after the mathematicians, then came the empiricists in England. This was Julian Huxley, the grandson of Thomas Henry Huxley, who wrote his great work, Evolution, the Modern Synthesis, which was published in 1942, and then in America, one has Theodosius Dobzhansky, the Russian-born geneticist, who in 1937 published his great work, Genetics and the Origin of Species. And with this, what we start to find is that evolution is now being upgraded. And one of the things that we start to find is that as evolution is being upgraded, is that these people realize, and that they found a journal in 1947, Evolution, and all of these sorts of things. And one of the things these people realized, as they started to upgrade what they were doing, was they had got to, as it were, get rid of this evolution as a secular religion, evolution and the meaning of life. They got to make a science which was going to be much more experimental, which was going to be more mathematical, which was going to be quantifiable, and also then a science which could get university support, a science which could get students, and all of these sorts of things. And they did this very successfully indeed. However, all of these people, all of these reformers around 1930, all of these people had gotten into evolution because of Thomas Henry Huxley style type views. Every one of these people really thought that evolution was more than just a science. They thought that evolution was a world picture that leads up to humans and beyond, and that it makes good sense. They realized that they couldn't push this as part of their public persona, not as scientists, because the culture of science demands that science be, as it were, non-religious. And so they were kind of schizophrenic, and they had to do two things. They had to, as it were, do their professional science, and they had to do their, as it were, popular science separately. And this is very much what we find happened, that the popular science didn't go, but it got put on one side. It got added to. And so we got what I call the Deo-Darwinian division. You got professional science, where people didn't talk about progress, where people didn't talk about the meaning of life, didn't talk about the status of humans and that sort of thing. And then you'd also got the popular science, where they talked about these sorts of things. And so generally what these great new batch of evolutionists did was they'd write two sets of books. Probably the best one to do this was the brightest one of them all, George Gaylord Simpson, the paleontologist. So in 1944, Simpson wrote what was in fact his greatest work, Tempo and Mode in Evolution, applying Darwinian ideas to the fossil record. Not a mention of God, not a mention of man, not a mention of progress, or any of these things. Then in 1949, Simpson goes to Yale. This is, says 1950, but it was 1949. Simpson goes to Yale and gives a series of popular lectures on evolution. The meaning of evolution, a study of the history of life and its significance for man. It's basically the same book as he'd written before, without the mathematics, with two more chapters on the meaning of life and why the American way is better than the Russian way, because 1950, the Cold War is starting, and these sorts of things. And then at the beginning of the book, he says, and this book is for the general reader. So, as it were, this makes it all okay. And then 1953, he rewrites Tempo and Mode in Evolution, and goes right back to po-faced professionalism, not a mention of any of the other things. So what you've got then, I think, is a kind of tension in evolutionary theory, with people feeling in themselves that evolution is more than just a story, but realizing that the culture of science demands that they keep it straight, folks, damp it down. And I think that this is something which continues to this day, and we still see these tensions coming out to this day. And I think that this leads us into why the creationists and the biblical literalists and others are still so tense about evolution, is because evolution so often is not just a scientific theory, but it's more than that. I don't mean that evolution cannot be just a scientific theory. What I say is, so often, it's more than just that. So let me take just one example, and I think I take a very fair example. Probably, certainly Ernst Mayr is probably the most prominent, the greatest evolutionist in America alive today, but certainly number two or number three is this man, and this is Edward O. Wilson, the Harvard entomologist and sociobiologist. And if you look at Wilson's greatest work, which I think is his work Sociobiology, The New Synthesis, which was published in 1975. If you look at this, this is a very careful and very detailed discussion about animal behavior, about the kin selection, R selection, about pheromones and all of these sorts of things, the sort of things that professional scientists do, the sorts of things that is taught in the biology courses here on your campus and on mine and so forth. But underlying book, this very big book, is more than that. There's a message, folks. There's a message that it means something, because if you look at the book, Wilson very explicitly starts with the ants, and he's talking about social animals, and then he says, higher than the ants are to be found the lion. lions. And then higher than the lions are to be found the great apes. And then taram, 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 at the end, the sort of epiphany of the evolutionary process is sociobiological man. I'm never quite sure why sociobiological man is always portrayed in a suit with the DNA, but he always is. But anyhow, the whole thing, it's a message. It's a message, just as much of a message as you're getting back in Erasmus Darwin, that evolution means something, it means something for us. And of course, not surprisingly, Wilson has written more recent books like Consilience and Naturalist, where of course he's quite, in full Herbert Spencer style, he's pushing all sorts of things like, you know, maintain, we've grown in symbiotic relationship with plants, so we must maintain the rainforests, otherwise we'll wither and die. And all of these messages come out. So what I'm saying is that evolution to this day carries on the Thomas Henry Huxley legacy, and I think that the critics often see this, and this is what makes them tense. So certainly, we've certainly got it. I mean, we've got this rather peculiar-looking chap is, in fact, a philosopher. I mean, you know he's a philosopher because you can see his brain. This is Dan Dennett, who wrote Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And Dennett is unabashedly using his evolutionism to push atheism, to push his view of ethics, to push all sorts of things like that. I mean, he's using it as a message. And what we're seeing is in the critics, and probably the greatest critic today from the religious side is this man, if we can ever get him up, is Philip Johnson, just recently retired as law professor at Berkeley, who wrote a little book called Darwin on Trial, where Darwin is not only put on trial, but led away in chains for the rest of his life. And you see again and again and again, what is worrying people like Johnson is not just the fossil record. That's just, as it were, a symbol for what really worries him, which he thinks is the kind of secular humanism, you know, free sex and, you know, reading Playboy and watching too much television and drinking and taking philosophy and all the degenerate things that one has in the modern world. And he sees evolution as epitomizing this. And what I want to say is that maybe they've got a point. I'm not saying that evolution has to be this way, but I'm saying that it often is to this day portrayed this way, often for very good reasons, but I think one should recognize that this is what happens. And I think that that, therefore, is why we have so much controversy about evolutionism, not just simply because the creationists have taken it upon themselves to be difficult, but because the evolutionists themselves trail their coats. Thank you very much.
Professor Roos, thank you so much. Now I would like to invite first Professor Bruce Tiffany and then Professor Stephen Rothstein to come up and deliver some short comments, and you get to decide for yourself which indeed is the beloved shaggy one.
Well, I will make an apology at the outset, or an excuse as the case may be, for both Professor Rothstein and myself. We got hit with bait and switch. We were given a chance to be able to reflect at great length on this evening's proceedings because we had a copy of the paper in advance, but unfortunately, it wasn't the paper that Professor Roos read. So this leaves me very definitely punting. And let me punt this way. I find this a fascinating insight, and a small portion of my thunder from tomorrow evening has indeed been stolen, but I'll figure another way to up the volume. Don't worry, I have another day on some of the history. And I have learned a great deal and fitted in a few small holes in my own knowledge that were not explained. I find particularly interesting Huxley's role in this, and suddenly a bunch of things fall into line, and I thank you for that insight. One of the places which there's sort of a continued emphasis on here is the use of the use by evolutionists of evolution as an excuse for advancing a social cause. And I think that, yes, there are a lot of evolutionary biologists who are very guilty of that, and I, as an evolutionary biologist, a paleontologist of very dead plants, take great exception with individuals who do so, because I basically figure that science is about an unbiased approach and look at the natural world, that it should not be used to advance any particular cause. You can advance that cause after the fact if you wish, but it should not be biasing how you do your science. On the other hand, every one of the examples that has been given here has been an example of individuals who have, in a sense, sort of stopped, as I think of it, Well, it's not at the level of humans, and they've thought of evolutionary biology as a way for excusing some aspect of their philosophy of how humans operate. I think if we take evolution by natural selection in its proper sense, and let me briefly give a definition here, that evolution by natural selection is a term that humans use to describe the interaction of random genetic variation, that is, genetic variation arising within the organism, not under the control or plan of the organism, random genetic variation interacting with random environmental change. Again, that means you don't, when you are born as an organism of any kind, you don't get to choose whether you came out with a long fur appropriate for cold environment or not. The environment is what it is. Your genetics are what they are. The two interact, and that leads to differential survival and reproduction. Natural selection is not, as many people envision it, some sort of great big goon with a baseball bat waking up, knock you off, as sort of an outstanding force there that's going to pick you off if you don't fit. It is simply a description of these two chance interactions. That is the random in natural selection. A lot of what I think has been described this evening, the individuals who are thinking about it have kind of forgotten the aspect of the random. And they're really looking towards, indeed, an aspect that gets us up towards humans. And we're focusing in yet again upon ourselves. This is, I think, cuts with two edges, because on the one hand, we get real worried when our position is challenged, when suddenly a question is raised about why we are here, or that maybe we are not the pinnacle of evolution. And the other side of it is that we really are, by focusing on ourselves, ignoring this aspect of random and what might else be brought around by the processes of evolution. We look at the concepts of advancement and progress and what organism is the most important in this world. Is it a suit-coated individual with a bow tie, white male, et cetera, giving this lecture, or is it a clam? And, of course, most people would say that it's the suit-coated individual, except the females in the audience who know who's really important here. But on the other hand, I invite you, I grant the clam, if we bring the clam in here, will probably be bored out of its mind, what small mind it has at this talk. But on the other hand, I invite you to try filter feeding. And it becomes a serious question, beneath several feet of water for a considerable period of time. It becomes a really serious question as we start to question about the nature of advancement and what does advancement mean, what does progress mean, that we have to measure it perhaps not going in the directions of what we are, but evolution and organisms as a whole, that there is an enormous diversity of organisms out there. I'd argue that really a true evolutionist should look around at this planet full of manipulative hairless apes and not see those organisms as potentially the goal of evolution, but simply as a way station as to who knows what's going to be created next, who knows where we're going in the final analysis. Indeed, for all we know, God may have six legs and big compound eyes, and Armageddon is not about something in a religious experience in our case, but it's simply a way to cleanse the earth off of pestiferous little hominids so the insects and the plants can go on and exist in paradise. Again, being caught slightly off base, I think that the bottom line that I would take from this is, yes, there's been a strong emphasis here on the focus on using evolution as an excuse for, as it were, human standing in the world. I think a real evolutionist who takes the random aspects of evolution in hand sees that no organism is preferred, that all organisms stand in their own individual environments, and that really what evolution by natural selection and the whole concept of evolutionary biology should be about is simply better understanding the world. Thank you.
As Professor Rothstein comes up, I'd just like to remind you, if you do have questions you'd like to deliver to any our speaker or our panelists, please complete them, and we'll walk up and down the aisles, and please deliver your index cards to the aisles.
I feel somewhat at a double disadvantage. If you remember Dr. Roos's seminar, I'm the clean-shaven one that was to be killed. So I'm at a real difficulty here. I'd like to thank Jim for inviting me to participate in this event, and Michael for a really fascinating overview of the history of evolution. As an evolutionary biologist, I've been aware of some of this history, but it was really wonderful to see it laid out in such wonderful detail and so cohesively. The thing that I would like to do in my remarks is to go to the remarks that I had prepared, which deal with one aspect of Dr. Roos's seminar, talk, and that is the idea that the conflict between evolution and Christianity is in part due to evolutionary biologists, and also the idea that there is some compatibility between evolution and Christianity. In other words, we can reconcile these two sets of beliefs. I think there is some value in reconciling the belief in Christianity and other religions with evolution. And I can even refer to my own experience for this at the practical level of educating college students. For many years, I taught the evolution segment of the general biology class. And I would occasionally be greeted by hostile fundamentalists who demanded that creation science be given some attention in the course. There was really nothing I could do to satisfy these students because there is no scientific basis for dealing with creation science. If you are a fundamentalist, you believe in a literal reading of Genesis, and that's not compatible with evolution and with a number of other major branches of science. Sometimes I'd get students who would come to me who were really conflicted. And their problem was they were going through a very painful experience. They had become convinced, probably not through my great teaching, but maybe through the textbook, that evolution really was valid, that it had occurred. But these were students who had a lot of religious training, and they were having a real problem trying to deal with their religious beliefs on one hand and the belief that evolution really had occurred. The only thing I could do with such students was to tell them to try to separate their thought processes in these two areas, and that when they were thinking about evolution, to try not to think about anything that relates to religion, and vice versa when they were in a religious setting. I think I may have provided some comfort to these students. I think a history of the development of evolution, such as Professor Roos has presented, might have provided even more comfort to the students. Now, while I do see value in trying to reconcile these two sets of beliefs, I find myself somewhat closer to Dawkins' views that these views really are incompatible. I see the value in reconciling it because many people do have religious beliefs, and it would be good if they can also be exposed to evolution, and evolutionary biology. The one thing I don't share is Dawkins' need to be openly hostile towards religion. I have a lot of experience with people who are deeply religious, and I know that this really does improve their lives in very important ways. So religion certainly has some very good benefits. A question I spend a lot of time wondering about is whether the benefits of religion outweigh the costs, because we do know that religion has been a prime mover in many very, very nasty things in the history of man, and even today, religion is a prime mover in some very nasty conflicts throughout the world. I'd like to say a little bit about my own area in evolution, which is called behavioral ecology. Behavioral ecology looks at naturally occurring behavior of animals with the paradigm that behavior has been shaped by natural selection. Now, an overarching result of behavioral ecology, which has become a widely popular discipline in just the last 15 years or so, is that nature is pervasively cruel and underhanded. We see very little goodness in nature. In fact, what is so striking about animal behavior and really antithetical to Christian values is not that there is so much evil in the natural world, but that there really is nothing good that one can see that can't be explained by natural selection favoring individuals that selfishly advance their own genetic interests, typically at the expense of other individuals. Now, one important thing I have to point out when I say something like that is just because we can point to something that occurs naturally, it does not mean that that is something then that's good that people should emulate. And this is a real problem that society has, and maybe evolutionary biologists have, in trying to bring to society what they know. There's nothing about evolutionary biology or the way evolutionists think that indicates that anything that we can determine that occurs naturally is something that should be condoned and is wonderful and people should emulate it. For example, there's some really horrible behavior that many animals do, such as infanticide. Infanticide occurs naturally, and it has real adaptive value for the perpetrator of infanticide. But no one would argue that that means then that we should condone infanticide. It's good to understand the basis of this, that when animals carry it out, but no way should we then follow that. Now, in terms of reconciling beliefs, I think one can argue that these examples of horrible, unethical behavior in nature are God's means of achieving certain ends, but my feeling is that there must be nicer, kinder ways to achieving a lot of these ends than all of the nasty things we can see animals doing in their behavior. Now, I can't refute the argument that we can't understand God's purpose, or that there has to be suffering and bad things to make it clear that there are really good things that exist. But I would like to suggest that there really is no reason why we would make such an argument other than a predisposition towards accepting religion. Now, where does that predisposition come from? Historically, I think it's pretty clear it comes from primitive humans, ancient people, and their fear of the unknown. They were exposed to really scary things, earthquakes. They were exposed to obviously powerful things on a daily basis, like the sun. And giving some spiritual value to this, some religion, at least provided some basis for understanding. And I think that this must have been of some comfort to people to begin with. And then, as E.O. Wilson has argued, having these beliefs, these doctrines, which eventually matured into religions with their own doctrines, probably would add to group cohesiveness, and this group cohesiveness would enhance group survival. Now, the historical explanation for the origin of a belief in religion, I think, in God is pretty easy when we deal with humans in general. But what about events shaping an individual's life today? Given that we have materialistic, scientific explanations for virtually all phenomena that humans can directly experience with their own senses, why would someone who believes in Darwinism also believe in Christianity or any other religion? I don't think that the ultimate basis for such a belief in religion lies in the fact that Darwinism can't disprove all of the tenets of Christianity, or because some aspects of Christianity are compatible with evolution. My guess is that people are predisposed to take this dualist view, which some people do, of believing in Darwinism and Christianity because of their early experience, which is a major shaper of the behavior of humans and animals, other animals. But what shapes early experience? Researchers studying animal behavior have a powerful type of experiment that can be applied to tease apart what an individual learns, either early in life or at a later stage, versus what it's innately predisposed to do without experiencing another individual's behavior. And applied to the current subject, the behavior in question would be the human predisposition to believe in religion, Christianity, God, or any type of supernatural entity. Where does this come from in the modern world? The experiment that biologists do is pretty simple. It's an isolate rearing experiment. You take an infant individual, remove it from its parents before it could have experienced anything relevant to the behavior of interest. It's then reared to maturity, and you can then determine whether it exhibits the behavior in question. Of course, we can't do this experiment with people. It's very unethical. You'd never get a grant that would fund the project for a sufficiently long period. Nevertheless, we would ideally take an infant, isolate him or her from human contact, or at least isolate this individual from all exposure to religion, all exposure to evolution. We try to give the individual enough training to make sure he or she is literate. And then as a teenager or a young adult, when they've really got the intelligence to try to synthesize things, we would expose him or her to the basis for believing in evolution and for believing in Christianity. We would then ask them to use their powers of deduction to determine whether they believed in evolution, Christianity, or both. My bet is that after hearing the background information, the subjects would believe in evolution. I really find it very unlikely that without the early prior experience, any or many of these subjects would choose to also believe in Christianity or any organized religion, the absence of the of early exposure to religion that made them sympathetic to this viewpoint. So my point is the main reason we, I think, have these kinds of discussions is that our early views have been shaped so much by a predisposition towards religion. You know, after all, little children don't go to evolution school or general science school on their religion's day of worship, whether it's Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. I suspect that without the sympathy for religion that is created by early experience, that very few people would choose to believe in both evolution and an organized religion like Christianity. Given the fact that we do have this early experience, I think it's fine to reconcile the two viewpoints, and I think that that really is the best thing. I don't think we necessarily have to go fighting with one another, the evolutionary biologists and the people who represent religion. And again, I would... The last thing I want to say is that the way the public views evolutionary biologists is really different than the way most evolutionary biologists view themselves and the kinds of things that we really do. Obviously, the people who speak for evolutionary biology, who try to apply evolution to society and indicate that it has some great insights and things that society should follow, are the people who get the most attention. But most evolutionary biologists, as Bruce said, are pretty much in there doing their own thing. And sometimes this may be misused. And there is, I will agree with Michael that biologists and probably all academics probably could do a better job of trying to explain to the general public exactly what they do. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you to both Bruce and Stephen for their comments. And we are again gathering your own questions. We'll try to ask as many as we can in the time we have. But those were rather provocative comments now, Bruce and Stephen. And I think we should allow just a few minutes for you to interact. Michael, if you would like to make any response to the assertions that were made in the two sets of comments.
Let the audience have a say now, yeah.
Okay, very good. So if you have any questions specific to either of the two commentators as well as the speaker, we'll see what we can fit in. I guess this one is perhaps for you, Michael. How can Christianity's view of Jesus coexist with the Darwinian notion of a God as a non-moving mover, that is, one that lets the world evolve without his influence?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's a number of ways in which one can do this. One is that one can move Christianity more to a God whose miracles don't require violations of nature. Certainly a lot of Christians today, liberal Christians, but not all that liberal, for instance, would want to say, surely a miracle like the changing of water into wine, the marriage at Cana, shouldn't be thought of as Jesus as a kind of bootlegger or something like that. Isn't it more appropriate to think that because Jesus was there and the love and whatever it is that he brought forth, that the father-in-law who'd got this wine stashed in the back for himself realized that he should share it with other people and things of that nature. So that would be one way, I think, that one could bring Christianity and Darwinism into more closer harmony. The other way, and it's a traditional way, is simply to say, well, we want to draw a distinction between what is known as the order of grace and the order of nature. The order of nature is evolution, but that it so happens that God saw, God the Creator, who can do these things if he wants, God saw that human beings were in a deeply sinful state and that without his intervention, it was going to be curtains for them, and so decided to intervene, send his only begotten son. And so there are these miracles laid on top of the general law of nature. Now, that's another position that one could take, and I suspect that that's a position taken by a fair number of fairly conservative religious thinkers. I mean, I don't know where the Pope stands, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's the kind of position that the Pope would take. So there are strategies open for doing these things. They're not strategies which were just invented for Darwinism. I mean, these are strategies that church has been playing with for 1800 years.
Okay, I'd like to ask two related questions that'll give you a chance perhaps to reframe your conclusion, Michael. The first, if it is logically possible to be both a Christian and an evolution proponent, then why do we see a problem around us? And the second related question refers to the bumper sticker wars, which I'm sure you know. How many of you have one of those, by the way? The fish or the Darwin fish and so forth. The question is that just a joke or is there serious competition still going on there?
Well, now, the first question I thought I'd try to answer in my talk. I'm happy to get up and do it again.
Now we'd have to wire you again.
I think that this is a historical phenomenon to a certain extent. And in many respects, I see the evolution creationism debate as being, at a certain level, a manifestation of another debate, perhaps a deeper debate, between those who feel that progress and the way that we've got, that life moves, is in fact, generally speaking, a good thing, and those who don't, those who feel that life has become altogether too fast and that morals and these sorts of things are breaking down and that the ways of the past were better. And, I mean, I think this is a genuine and worthwhile debate. And I don't think it's all right on one side or all right on the other side. But I do see this as a debate which is going on in society, in all societies. It just so happens, I think, that in America, because of fairly specific reasons, namely the place of religion, particularly Protestant religion, in your culture, this is the way that it manifests itself more in America. I'm sure that one could find, if one looked at other societies like England, say, or France, one would see the same sorts of debates going on, but not necessarily in the evolution creationism debate.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Briefly discuss the notion of the origins of a belief in evolution and how Christianity may have set the stage for this. I think Michael has very convincingly shown that evolution, at least some aspects of evolutionary thought, did arise from some aspects of Christianity. Problem we have, I think, today is that this historical relationship is not the way evolutionary biologists have developed their interest in evolution and their knowledge. It's, I would say, as someone who's lived the experience, I've had some religious training, but that had nothing to do with my desire to go into evolution and to be interested in it. And I really can't think of any evolutionary biologist who would say today that their interest in evolution arose from some background in religion. So I think there's sort of a disconnect between the historical sequence and what actually occurs today shaping the evolutionary biologists that we have.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I'm not convinced with you that there's no one today. I mean, Ed Wilson, I realize he's growing old and going out, as it were, but certainly Ed Wilson got into the evolution, I think, because as a sort of substitute for his Christianity, he fell amongst the evolutionists and this, as it were, from a very early age, I think, was a satisfying substitute for the baptism of his youth. But I would agree with you. I think it's absolutely right that today's evolutionists, by and large, the job has been done, that you are not like Dobzhansky and co. coming into it because of that. I'm not saying there's no one, but I would say that that's probably been the case. But, of course, what has happened, I think it's fair to say, is that now, I mean, Wilson is an interesting case of somebody who's trying to do both, is I think that now we've tended to sort of split more, and we've got professional evolutionists like you, and then more and more we've got professional popularizers like Dawkins. I know that Gould doesn't want to consider himself that way, but he is a bit that way. Like Dennett, like Roos, if you like. Certainly people like Robert Wright, for instance, you know, who is a popular writer about evolution, with all sorts of messages that he's trying to put across. So I think it's still going on, but I think your point is very well taken, that what has happened now is, whereas it, previously it was together, it is now split and splitting.
What I would now try to join in the conversation, Aaron, on the third try. There's a variety of responses because several comments have gone by. First off, with respect to the most recent one, history, I think that part of the problem is that a lot of evolutionary biologists, as well as the general public, would profit enormously by hearing the history of the development of the idea of science and the development of the idea of evolution, whereupon this would make sense in a cultural context rather than being, as it were, sprung upon them full-blown from the brow of Zeus as, you know, take it or leave it. Many people, when they see something and it's evolutionary history, historical evolutionary history, develop a better sense of why the end product is where it is in the present day. And I find that certainly in my own genesis as a scientist, where I was early alluded to, came in entirely because of science and sort of backtracked and said, how did I get here? What is science? How did my science evolve? Then I developed a much stronger sense of why it is I do what I do in the present day. Jim posited the question of the Darwin fish, the infamous little character with feet. And I think that this is one of the most major mistakes that anybody has made in the field of science. Because, hey, if you look at a Jesus fish on the back of a car, that is a religious figure and a saint. By having a Darwin fish on your car, which I will not, thank you, I may have a fish with feet, but I won't have one that says Darwin. We are canonizing Darwin and raising Darwin up similarly as somehow a religious figure, which is precisely what we do not need to do. So, too, we make science into a bit of a religion when somebody like Dawkins argues for science as a support for atheism. Theism, deism on the one hand, atheism on the other hand, they're all about belief knowledge. They're not the opposites that Dawkins would have you believe. They're, you know, either you choose to believe or you really choose to believe not to believe. The only thing that science really tells you is agnosticism. That is, I want more data. And being as an agnostic, and most human beings being dualistic at the very least, if not schizophrenic in all but medical definition. I'll speak for myself. That is very possible to obtain and maintain.
Which one of yourselves?
Which one of myself? That one just ran away before I could blame it. That it is possible, I think, very easily to be, as many scientists have, to segregate portions of self in doing science, doing religion. The real question is how effectively can you keep those separate in your efforts, or how often do they, as I think you have given a very good example, does one sort of creep over into the other? And I think this is a very interesting portion in the history of science, and looking at how science is done, to begin to seriously ask how cultural backgrounds influence people's approaches to science. As I said this afternoon in a discussion, and borrowing on a graduate student's work in the office here, in the audience here, that a very fascinating question would be, would an evolutionary biologist who is a Hindu or an evolutionary biologist who was brought up in the Shinto religions of Japan see evolution differently than an evolutionary biologist who's a Christian? There's room for looking around here at how humans use science.
Okay, here's a question that may require just a minute of clarification, and Michael, we'll start with you. Do you have any comments about intelligent design theory and its role in the Darwinism-religion split?
Intelligent design is an idea which has been floated around for the last 10 years by a number of people, mainly associated with the so-called Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. Michael Behe, whose picture I showed you at the beginning, was one of the people One of the people who pushed this idea first from a scientific point of view, and more recently a young man called Bill Dembski, a mathematician, has been pushing it. And as my commentator just pointed out, in fact, this is a very old idea brought up to speed, if you like, by molecular biology and modern mathematics, namely that the way that we must explain the world is not through laws, but through intervention of some kind. And as you pointed out, that was very much the position that Archdeacon Paley had. My problems with intelligent design are twofold. First of all, I don't think it's needed scientifically. I think that evolutionary biology does a pretty damn good job. And I think it's a paradigm on the roll. And so I don't see the need for invoking miracles or anything like that. Theologically, I also have problems with intelligent design, because if indeed there was an intelligent designer and it was needed, for instance, to create the really intricate, the eye, the hand, the brain, or whatever, then why on earth didn't the intelligent designer step in when things go wrong? I mean, we only need one mutation, one little mutation, to cause sickle cell anemia, something which causes horrendous pain, horrendous unhappiness, and death for countless, you know, numbers of human beings. One little change of one little mutation would have done it. Yet this intelligent designer, who apparently can make the eye and the hand and whatever, just doesn't give a bugger about somebody about to die of sickle cell anemia. And I think that that is a major theological problem.
I would just add to that, for those who might have been at the first talk, who are not at the first talk in this series this year, the same question was asked at that earlier talk, and one of the commentators, who happened to be a female colleague of mine, said, intelligent design, tell that to a woman about to give birth.
I would echo that last comment. There are a lot of things in biology that aren't that intelligently designed, because there is the issue of just historical accident. I mean, if I was designing a vertebrate, I would, or human or any other vertebrate, I would not put my esophagus behind my trachea so that I could choke on food that I want to get down into my esophagus. I would arrange it the other way. But we have these historical accidents, and I think that this shows that while there are very complex things, not everything is designed really intelligently, which it should be if there had been divine intervention.
I'd like to briefly ask some questions of our two discussants as well, and we're still awaiting one for the shaggy one in the middle. Bruce, you're off the hook temporarily. I think you were the shaggy. Was he the shaggy one, Michael?
I think I was the shaggy.
Did I? Okay.
He sure looks like one.
Okay. We'll figure that after lecture. For Stephen, you question the benefits versus the costs of religion. Could you comment on how we could do the same for science beyond the ideal that it is always good?
Okay. My first question is, any chance cross your wires on that one? Because I believe...
Did I say Bruce instead of Stephen when I said Stephen?
I think you were the one who talked about benefits.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
I mean,
yes,
I'm perfectly happy to dive into it, but let's...
Give Stephen the first shot. Okay, Bruce.
I might prefer that you take... Well, I mean, science is about finding things that we think are general truths, and I really think that the great majority of this is going to result in good. I think most of the bad that comes from it is science that's misapplied. Mm-hmm. My last remark, I do think scientists and probably all academics could do a better job of communicating with the general public. This is something my wife tells me all the time, because I do arcane things like go off and study birds and record them and so on, and she thinks it's pretty good, it's pretty neat, but she realizes that most people think it's probably a waste of time and of taxpayers' money.
I'm wondering, just briefly here, because, Stephen, you presented some comments that were different in some ways from that of Michael's argument. Should we identify any potential dangers to seeking rapprochement between Darwinism and Christianity? Are there only benefits to be realized in finding ways to harmonize these disparate systems? That's a question to any of you.
Gosh, I don't know. Are there any benefits? Well, at one level, I suppose there are only benefits in the sense of, you know, people trying to get on and trying to reach resolutions. On the other hand, I mean, if the day that Christians and evolutionists agree to get on, people like me are out of a job. You know, it's a bit like, you know, the most unpopular person in the medical world will be the chap who discovers cancer, because there'll be no more grants, or discovers the cure for cancer. So, I mean, not entirely cynically, I mean, I have to say that speaking as an academic, and I'm sure I speak for everybody else at this table, an awful lot of life is, the fun of life is not just discovering, but it is arguing and trying to push your ideas and having other people disagree with you. I'm sure that you must feel this, that you make some discovery about your birds, and somebody in North Carolina has got a different position, and that adds a certain zest to what you're doing, doesn't it? Of course it does. And so at a certain level, I cannot say that I find myself entirely disappointed by these issues. And I think also, more than that, I think that even intelligent designers can help us, certainly help people like me, to think about what I do hold. And, you know, if I'm going to go on holding these ideas, to rethink them. I mean, you know, it's a vanishing return on this. I mean, how many, you know, times do I have to listen to Genesis over and over again before I can say enough? But, I mean, I wouldn't want to rule it out entirely.
I like to tell my students that the sad thing about science is it's done by humans. And I think my response to this particular question, either other than the pluses or minuses of science, or the pluses or minuses of integrating Christian views and evolution, that I think somebody's going to figure out a way for using it for evil. Somebody's going to figure out a way to invert it and make it wrong and more of a point of argument. I think that in any human endeavor, what one tries to do is to understand and then to deal with the understandings that come through in as ethical a manner as possible. To the degree that any of these discussions can allow us to better understand our own positions, then we have prospered. But again, I am sure there is some human being out there who will manage a way to use this to evil.
Maybe I have a somewhat different viewpoint. I think it would... reconciling the two would be good. Despite my isolation experiment, I know that's not going to happen, and people are going to have religious views. And as I said, there certainly are benefits that come from that. I mean, the problem I have with the debate is I think it goes around in circles and circles. I haven't really seen any really new arguments. And while it's fun to get in there and argue at times, I'm not sure that we're seeing anything productive coming out of this dispute anymore. So, because it's a lot of the same arguments on each side. So I would like to see some reconciliation and get on with other things.
Well, I can tell you that I hope we don't get that reconciliation, because we have 5 more lectures this spring and no one would come, including Bruce Tiffany's tomorrow night. So I would like to thank Michael Ruse, Professor Michael Ruse, and all participants in tonight's event. Please feel free to join us if there are any refreshments left and a general reception to be held in the back. And please remember tomorrow night's lecture by our own Bruce Tiffany, The Origins of Science and Religion, or Parents and Offspring Should Respect Each Other, 7 p.m., Isla Vista Theater. Thank you very much. Good night.